Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What is going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, my friend? How are you?
Chilling, man, as per usual. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay. So, did you hear about Vladimir Putin wants to clone ancient horse lords, the Thraki?
Yes, I did hear about that, and it is fucking fascinating. And I can't wait to talk about it.
So the Russian government, and I'm really surprised that Rachel Maddow hasn't picked this up yet, but the Russian government, they're planning on cloning Dothraki warriors from Game of Thrones.
Right.
And amassing them on the border of Russia and Ukraine so they can go in and they can start raping and pillaging the Ukraine.
Well,
and then that Dothraki horde is going to tear through Ukraine, and then it's going to hit, countries like Lithuania and Estonia, and make it all the way to Western Europe, where they are one army. And hopefully, they don't actually link up with the Unsullied Warriors with the Daenerys Targaryen, because then that will.
I don't think it's
going to
go down that way, man. I honestly think you're. I mean, the Dothraki horse warriors were great, but right now, I mean, like. Yeah, you saw the final battle with the Dothraki. They're basically just cannon fodder, right? They're going to rush out just like they did at that final battle, right?
Poor leadership.
Yeah, just poor leadership. They're just going to rush out into Ukraine. And they're going to get mowed down by American weapons. And then the Russians will step in later, you know? It's just cannon fodder.
Well, you're underestimating them because they have the ability to regenerate. Because that episode, the Long Night or Battle of Winterfell, they all seem to have perished in some misguided charge with flame swords.
Seriously.
Just terrible tactics, by the way, the way that they line that up. If you guys know that episode of Game of Thrones, possibly the worst display of medieval tactics I think that's ever been
the worst
presented.
Display of military tactics.
Military,
period.
ever. Yeah. It was just. You could have found one dork on YouTube who could have thought of a better way to do that.
A better battle
episode.
Plan against
but,
the whites.
Yeah. They, you know, even though they all seem to have perished in the very beginning of that battle, they seem to have revived right before they sacked King's Landing.
Yeah, at least some of
them.
They
were all there. Like they seemed like they were back. They were back. Yep. So I think that you underestimate that ability. Mm-hmm. All right, so
not to get too
off track on that. So one of our listeners, where we're going with this, one of our listeners shared this article on Twitter with me, and he was like, "Hey, this is gonna be really up your alley," and I was like, "Yeah, you're right. This is definitely something that we'd be interested in speaking about."
Yep. When you sent it to me, like I just read the title and I'm like, "Yep, let's do it." I didn't read a single thing about it. I was like, just title alone, I'm like, I'm interested. Let's do it.
And it's the perfect story that lives in the crossroads of what we talk about, and mm-hmm. it basically sits in the intersection between, you know, modern global politics, ancient civilizations, and then add fringe propaganda to that as well. So in the Russian Republic of Tuva, which is in southern Siberia, there have been these archaeological excavations. Tuva in the past was, and still is home to...
The Republic of Tuva, that is.
Yeah, the Republic of Tuva is home to, I guess, the descendants of nomadic-type people. It's more Asiatic and less Slavic-looking, the people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
And this... this area was ruled by Mongols for a long time, and it was also part of China for a couple of hundred years. Tuva actually didn't become part of Russia until like around the 20th century, the early 20th century, right, like prior to World War One. But these excavations that are going on are of these tombs of Scythian royalty.
Yep.
And this article was just released from ancientorigins.com, and it seems to have been syndicated to some other outlets as well.
DailyMail.co.uk.
Yeah, Daily Mail.
Fucking
Daily Mail
is like website.
the fourth largest newspaper in England.
I know, but I hate their website. It's just so riddled with ads, and they make you disable your ad blocker to read it. And that was one of the better versions of this particular article was on Daily Mail.
It was a shitty. It's a shitty website.
It's the shittiest made website, and I hate it. It angers me every time I have to go on it.
I know. It's and then
shame
like,
on you, DailyMail.co.uk
thing and the whatever those applications that just shove like ads down your face.
It's just every it's like the actual reading space is about like maybe 25% of the actual screen, and the rest of it is just nonsense links and like junk and like ads and just nonsense.
It's annoying. it's like look at this. They always have that like you won't believe. You will not believe what this child star will look like now.
Right. It's always some shit like that.
Like, oh my God, you will be struck by how beautiful this child is. They're always like weird, creepy stuff like that,
it's
too.
Like top 10, you know, nipple slips in sports or some stupid shit like that. You know, it's like something dumb all the time.
This person smoked meth for a day. See what she looks like 13 years later.
Yeah, and like 37 clicks later, you get like a two-sentence story.
Yeah. And then by the time you're done reading that, like your computer has needs AIDS. To be repaired. Like it's done.
Yeah.
It's broken.
Yeah.
All right, so the story is called Russia Wants to Clone Ancient Scythian Warriors. And I'll just go through it right now. It's not too long. So Russia's defense minister has announced his plan for the DNA cloning of ancient Siberian warriors and their horses. The ancient Tunig burial site located in the Valley of the Kings in the Republic of Tuva in Siberia holds the remains of 3,000-year-old Scythian warriors. So the Scythians are a group of ancient tribes of nomadic warrior-type people who are... just a quick synopsis. We're going to dive deeper into them in this show. Yep. But quick synopsis, they are a warrior-like people that existed between 900 BC and 200 BC. And they're basically known for clashing with every single civilization that existed in that time period that we know about in the Near East. So they clashed with the Persians. They clashed with the Assyrians. They clashed with the Greeks. They clashed with the Macedonians. Mm-hmm. They clashed with everyone.
Yep. Part of that was just like their location, though. They just happened to be in that, like, you know, crossroads in that marchland, if you will.
But, exactly. Yeah. And they're just, you know, they're known as kind of disruptors in history. They're like the precursors to the Mongols is a good way to think about them.
Yep.
So to go on with this article, now Sergei Shoigu, Russia's defense minister and one of Vladimir Putin's closest advisors. Sergei Shoigu is actually from Tuva. He's half Russian or half and his mother, I think, or no, his father. He's half Tuvan or Tuvanese, or I don't know what the correct
what
term
they call
is.
Themselves. He's like best boys with Putin, though. Like they're like real tight.
Yeah, it's one of his. He's been around forever. He's been on the upper cabinets there for a real long time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at him, he looks like he's half Asiatic. You know, he looks less Slavic. He's from there, so maybe this explains. You know, maybe some of his fascination with this.
Mm-hmm.
So he has disclosed his desire to use DNA cloning to recreate an army of noble warriors. However, is this story perhaps a high-level cover-up of the mask, the signals of impending war?
All right, so I I think this is a little bit stretchy because he didn't specifically say this, but golly, you continue, but...
It's very, very strange. So, basically, the crux of the article is that the Russians are trying to create this clone-like army, like in Star Wars.
Yep. Yep.
Which is just a wild accusation based off what we're going to get.
So they're bringing back
to
Jango Fetts. It's like they're crossing Star Wars and Game of Thrones, right? Instead of cloning Jango Fett, they're cloning the Dothrakis.
Yeah, they're cloning the
Khal Drogos, a bunch of Khal Drogos.
So archaeologists have been excavating the Tuva burial mound known as Arjan II since 1998, and a team of Russian and German archaeologists began excavating graves and tombs in the so-called Valley of the Kings in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Now a Russian-Swiss archaeological team is being tasked with finding samples for DNA cloning of an army of warriors. An army of warriors. Game over, man. Game over, man.
Oh, Jesus.
What the fuck are we going to do now? Game over.
Uh-oh.
You ever see Aliens?
Yeah.
Bill Paxton. Game over, man. Game over. What the fuck are we going to do now? Yeah, they're being tasked with to get these DNA cloning of army warriors. An article in the Daily Mail explains that ancient Tunic burial sites contains 3,000-year-old nomadic warriors, which were often laid to rest with their horses. Sergei Shigoy is from the Republic of Tuva, and he recently spoke about the potential of the extraordinary 3,000-year-old Scythian burials in the Valley of the Kings. The controversial bit is that this potential, he talks of, its sample of is to sample 3,000-year-old Scythian DNA so the military, so that military scientists can recreate an ancient army of advanced warriors.
Okay, stop there for a second. He didn't specifically say this, so I think they're definitely stretching this. Like, they paid somebody.
He didn't say anything like that.
Yeah, he didn't say anything like this.
He said was, "This is interesting."
Quote him. Let's quote him real fast. Hold on, but then let's go back to that next point after that because that's my favorite part of it, which is here. So what did he exactly say? He said, "He said it would be possible to make." Speaking about the DNA samples that he could potentially get from the mummies that they find, he said it would be very possible to make something of it, if not Dolly the sheep. And he also said, in general, it will be very interesting. None of that said anything about making like a race of super soldier Scythian Russians. There's no like that is a leap, a hop, skip, and a jump. You know, a giant leap forward from that one particular thing. But it is an interesting thing to say.
It makes for interesting content, at least.
Way. Speaking of interesting content, this next bit I really like a lot. So this part of the article I thought was hilarious. Yeah, according to the report in the Unilad 3 years ago, when Shoigu initiated the Russian-Swiss archaeological digs, he called in a, quote, modern-day shaman so as the excavations did not anger the spirits, because God forbid, you know, when we're trying to make our Russian Scythian clones, we anger the spirits.
Well, that'll be the undoing,
you know.
that's common courtesy. Like if you're digging up remains of people who are laid to rest, archaeologists, when they're digging up sites and they discover burial grounds, and then they figure out where like tombs are or where people, you know, if they'll find a symbol and like, oh, that's clearly a tomb here, they'll stop poking at it in those areas because they don't want to dig up dead bodies. They know it's kind of disrespectful.
They do want to dig up dead bodies.
I know, but they don't want to dig up all of them. You know what I mean? Like, they want to get one of them, but they don't want to continuously just like dig up all these people who are laid to rest once they figure out like the pattern
of
where they
lay. I think there's a fine line between,
or at least some
being
of them
respectful
are
of the dead and, you know, like engaging in some, you know, hokey pokey shamanism something or the other.
Well, they got they're going to dig them up. like they know that it's disrespectful, so they need to take precautions of getting some type of somebody who can speak with the spirits to prevent
and
them from being
therein
haunted.
Lies like that's what I find like odd, because archaeologists are scientists. They are like historians. You know, what place does this? You know, this isn't fucking Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, this isn't. You know, this. That's not a thing. I'm sorry.
I understand why they're doing that. They might as well get some type of, I don't know, at the very least to symbolize showing respect, because at least you can say like, hey, listen, we're showing the bodies respect. So we have, you know, we got this guy who wears like a necklace full of teeth and stuff, chanting some mumbo jumbo over the body. So.
Arise,
you know,
chicken,
a tree
arise.
Doesn't fall on them or something and they're asleep. So, all right. Last Wednesday, Zvezda TV said the Russian defense chief told an online session of the Russian Geographical Society, which was attended by Putin, of course, we would like to very much find the organic matter, and I believe you understand that would follow what would follow that. The defense chief added that the burials were discovered in permafrost, which should have preserved organic matter. Therefore, it would be possible to make something of it, if not Dolly the sheep, added Shugoy. He was, of course, referring to Scotland's July 1996 announcement that a female domestic sheep, Dolly, was the first mammal cloned from an adult somatic cell using the process of nuclear transfer. Let me try to put this whole story into perspective without getting myself into trouble. According to a 2017 PBS report, Russia's propaganda machine... Okay, this just goes on to say some goofy stuff. Yeah, let me read the last sentence because it's so cringy. Considering Russia's propaganda machine, let's now return to the session last Wednesday under normal circumstances in other countries apart from China. Yeah, would have thought Shugoy would have been mentioned Russia's recent deployment of almost 100,000 troops to the Ukrainian border. With the world's media watching, Russia fearing an impending war, the man who presses the big red buttons only talked about resurrecting an army of ancient Scythian warriors. This means one thing. It's time for Ukrainians to run for the hills.
Cringe. Cringe.
It's a fun little article that kind of is obviously incredibly conspiratorial and jumps to conclusions that, you know, probably really aren't real.
Right.
It is kind of akin to like Veterans Today type nonsense.
A little bit, yeah.
It is funny. I kind of appreciate little goofy articles like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any reasonable person could, in fact, take that seriously, that they're actually trying to clone a army of ancient peoples to, you know, somehow have some type of military advantage, because, you know, clearly, most likely, that wouldn't give you any type of military advantage in a practical sense.
Suddenly clone them and they don't all of a sudden remember their past and like, oh, yeah, I remember how to ride a horse and shoot fucking poison.
They're not going to descend from the ground like...
This imagine is a necromancy.
The shaman is like,
See, that's why they needed the shaman, because they're it's not cloning, it's necromancy. They're rising them from the dead. That's what they...
And they take like a horse, they cut open a horse and they like sprinkle the horse blood over this mount.
Yeah.
And it's like, And then all of a sudden, like, a storm comes and then all you see these hands just pop up. Out of the
lightning,
ground, like a pet cemetery.
Yep.
So all these hands just start popping out.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, yeah. And then they come out. And then
they hand them all Kalashnikovs. And they send them to Ukraine.
And they go, they march straight to Ukraine in like a slow march, like Game of Thrones style White Walkers that slowly come down.
Yep. It takes a whole season for them to get there.
It takes a whole season. And then when it comes down, you know, they're defeated in a very unclimactic way with some, you know, 15-year-old girl stabbing it in the heart.
I think you kind of pointed this out. This article is obviously clickbait, right? And what really kind of bothered me about this clickbait is that it's like not even close to believable. Because, you know, first of all, cloning is a touchy subject all across the world, like in general, just cloning anything, including a sheep, you know? But human cloning is like another, like if this were, if he were serious, right? If Russia was serious about cloning anyone, any human being at all, never mind, you know, ancient Scythian warriors, if they were like even coming close to this, this would be much bigger news, and it would be a different type of news. It'd be like a ethical or scientific debate about whether or not we should clone human beings, you know, let alone whether or not cloning ancient human beings could be used for military purposes. You know what I mean? So it's like they just went too far on the unbelievableness, which is why I found it just so absolutely, you know, just ridiculous, you know? Like if you wanted to make a more believable story, if I were doing this, I'd be like, I would just stop at they're thinking about doing cloning, you know, or they're thinking about, you know, using the genetic information that they find to like justify their, you know, claim to a certain land because of like DNA evidence or something like that. Like that would be a more believable clickbait, you know. This just seems like, just,
well, the clickbait worked because we're talking about it and we're promoting it. So,
right.
It's
no,
somebody like, who some people are going to be like, oh, okay, let me look at this shit, mm-hmm. and they're going to type in Google Russia cloning,
and then they're going to get all the ad money. So
and they're
going to
win, and they're going to make money.
Winning.
So in that sense, it was successful, and we're using this as a launch to talk about our topic anyway.
Right.
So
yeah,
it was a successful article in terms of what they were doing. But yeah, obviously for any sane person, it's not something that they're, I don't think anyone who reads this will come off thinking that, you know, this is like some type of security threat to the world that, that they're recreating these old ancient warriors, you know, weren't there, I am no expert on cloning, but you know, weren't there a lot of mistakes when it came to making Dolly? Like, since, you know, all the different...
I'm fairly certain Dolly was sterile, meaning, like, Dolly couldn't reproduce.
Well, a lot of the moral... Because I guess they cloned Dolly from the nuclear whatever process, fusion process. Well,
not to be confused with, like, nuclear power. Like a nucleus.
Nucleus.
The nucleus of Dolly the sheep's, you know, embryo, and then they basically did some fancy fucking science shit and was able to figure out a way how to inject the genetic material of itself into its own embryo, thus creating a perfect copy of itself. And then since Dolly's mother was a female, it was able to then carry that cloned version of itself to term.
Well, isn't one of the big moral dilemmas with cloning ancient peoples is that we know that there's going to be mistakes made in that process? And
well, it's not even just exclusive to ancient people. Like I was saying before, it this would extend to cloning anyone, you know, like,
yeah,
if we want to,
but especially
clone you,
especially,
you know,
ancient people. Like, you know, there's a debate in science. I don't know how serious a debate is, but there's a debate about cloning Neanderthals because we could probably do it, but it would. We don't have the nucleus that it would require to. We'd have to do it by a lot of experimentation, like how when.
And then there's ethical like issues with that because, you know, you might need to terminate a bunch of like unviable, you know, clones.
You'd have a Neanderthal that, you know,
we're not talking about like aborting a fetus. We're talking about like maybe it is like quote born, but it's like fucked up in many ways. And then you,
yeah, it has,
do you let it suffer or do you euthanize it? You know, and then that's like the ethical questions around it. You know,
and then we don't know what physical or, you know, what their intellectual power will be versus like a Homo sapien. You know, whether they'll be smarter or if they're considered mentally retarded by our standards, or if they, you know, are considered to have
some type
of... There
could also be biological concerns, right? Maybe they are, you know, they could be harbingers of disease, right? Or perhaps, you know, they could be extremely susceptible to our diseases, which is probably more true, and then they just die pretty much immediately, you know? So again, there's a million ethical concerns about cloning in general. And I think one of the more interesting ones is, like, you know, in the same region, they're trying to, like, get mammoth DNA and, like, clone a mammoth with Asian elephants and, like, try to bring back the woolly mammoth, you know? But the same set of you know, issues is present. But, you know, on the other side of that argument there, you know, it's possible that we could utilize cloning technology to unextinct animals that we are artificially driving extinct. You know, like the white rhino, as an example, just recently went extinct. We could maybe bring them back, you know? Or, you know, the dodo bird. Apparently those fuckers were tasty, you know? So, you know, there could be ways for us to you know, bring back ecosystems by using cloning technology. But, you know, again, this is all a wild ethical and scientific debate that's going on.
You know, they
on.
Made a movie about this?
About what?
About what we're topic? Talking about.
Really? I didn't know that. What was that? Jurassic Park?
Yeah. Knife finds a way. Yeah, it was a big hit back in the day.
Yep.
Well, the first one was good. I don't know. What's your opinion on Jurassic Park beyond the first one?
I find them all entertaining in their own respects, but none of them will live up to the first one.
Yeah, I agree. Well, what we thought this was a good... reason to talk about this, you know, it's a silly thing, not just to talk about cloning, but to kind of use this as a jumping off pad to talk about the story of Russian history, because we've been wanting right. to do you know, we did a podcast on on the history of Japan. I think it was a 6-part series or 7-part mm-hmm. series, and we wanted to do a similar thing with Russia. And we're going to do it a similar format. We're not going to do it straight like we did before, just like 7 continuous episodes of Japan. We're going to like kind of fit them in between. But we wanted to use this as an opportunity to talk about, you know, who the hell was living in Russia thousands of years ago.
Right. Kind of like
because
ancient.
That's a very unclear yeah. thing. Yep. You know, we always assume that nation states are... constant.
Existed in perpetuity. Right?
Yeah, they existed in perpetuity, that their lineage goes back many thousands of years. So when you say, hey, what was ancient Russia like, or what was Russia like, you know, 2,000 years ago? And you're like, okay, well, what were the ancient Russians like? Well, what did ancient, you know, there wasn't a Russia.
Come to find out that there wasn't a
there
Russia.
Wasn't such thing as a Russia, you know, the construct
or a
of
Russian people.
Russia yep. or the Russian people, something is something that existed not really that long ago compared to right. Written, you know, compared to written history or the time of the written history. And I want to jump this off about talking about the steppe, because I think it's a really important concept to understand what the steppe is. And people who listen to Dan Carlin, and this is how I originally learned about this stuff, through Dan Carlin's Hardcore History podcast.
Mm-hmm.
The Scythians are someone he's always talking about. The blood-sucking Scythians, you know. I think this kind of steered into my brain. And these people lived on the steppe, which was this incredibly open grassland that runs from Mongolia to Manchuria, pretty much through Central Asia, and then it extends out to the westwards to the Hungarian plains, the Great Hungarian Plains.
Right.
And this is a type of landscape that is just vast and wide open. Like, think of the Great Plains in the United States. It's just wide open. And
or the Dothraki Plains.
Or the Dothraki Plains, the great glass, the great grassland. Mm-hmm. You know, isn't it kind of funny that to teach, or I don't want to say we're teaching, but to like reference history, Game of Thrones is like something that's more relevant, and people know more stuff about Game of Thrones than actual history.
It's a useful tool, man.
It's a very useful tool. Well, that's because George R. R. Martin, he based a lot of Game of Thrones or the Ballad of, or Song of Ice and Fire mm-hmm. off things from real history. You yeah. know, he mm-hmm. so the Dothraki are kind of like they're a combination of the Mongolians and the Scythians and the and Huns, like these people who lived in these
areas.
But also
the Native Americans and things like that, yeah.
Yeah, like he combined, that's what they're based off of. They're supposed to represent these nomadic horse warrior people that, you know, were traveling in these large plains and were really scary and would clash with these civilized, you know, these pockets of civilization.
It's not a terrible way to think of this, you know. I think it's a helpful, useful tool, but it's not. It's obviously, you know, the real history is not exactly. They're not exactly Dothraki, but it's a helpful starting point.
Yeah, it is. It is a helpful starting point. But what makes people and you know, I think what ultimately kind of steers a culture to the way it is the geography. You know what. Where do they live, and what kind of conditions do people have to live off of or live in?
And we talked a lot about this actually in our on our episodes of ancient China, and how like the geography kind of dictates the types of people and the cultures and like how they live, just based around the geography. A lot of that has, you know, direct influence over that.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, and the steppe is like the major influence on this type of nomadic culture, because there's this is not a place where you settle. You know, there's nothing to really settle on. You know, there's not like these rivers or these little cradle pockets that you're gonna want to settle on. It's a place that just inspires movement, and the Scythians are one of these nomadic people that were always on the move. And something that's native to the steppe are horses. Like, this is a natural environment for horses. Something that's interesting, and I have to repost this. I think I'll repost this for our Patreons after this, because I think it would be kind of a nice kind of a supplementary podcast to us. But when we first started doing Bro History, I had an interview with
Dan Flores.
With Dan Flores, and something that Dan Flores told me, or what's in his book, is that horses were actually native to the United States, not the United States, but they were native to the Americas, because we all, you know, the story of horses in America, we all tend to think that
we brought them over on ships and
we brought them over on ships from Europe. But actually, horses were first native to, you know, the Great Plains and in the Americas, and they actually traveled and migrated to Europe when we were all connected, and then they went extinct in the Americas, and then they came back from Europe. So it's kind of an interesting evolution of that. So you have this open landscape, you have horseback people, and this kind of sense of constantly moving around. And another thing to add is that this place is really easy to get from one place to another.
Oh yeah,
so
wide open spaces.
I was listening to this lecture by a archaeologist named Barry Cuncliffe, and the way that he explained it is that if you got on your horse in the Great Hungarian Plain at the beginning of spring, and if you were traveling at a very normal rate eastwards, you would end up in Mongolia before winter. So we're talking about traveling a really long distance in a period of about 5 to 6 months.
Right. On a horse.
On a horse.
We're talking thousands and thousands of miles, though, like, just for context.
Yeah. So you're able to get from place to place very travel different land, from landscape to landscape very quickly.
Right, because you're not crossing mountains and shit.
Yeah, there's nothing in the way. There's just a few river valleys and that's it. And another thing that he was talking about in this lecture was the gradient, the step gradient, which was mm-hmm. real interesting. Essentially, it's whether from the west it would come across the Atlantic Ocean and bring moisture, and as weather moved east, it would gradually drop its moisture. So ultimately what you get in the western steppe, you would get these green pastures. So the Great Hungarian Plains in the Pontic Steppe in Europe, it's like this, you know, beautiful green pastures. And then on the flip side, on the east, the further east that you go, you get these drier, colder steppes. So for mm-hmm. example, the Mongolian steppe, where the Great Horde was from, their native steppe was very dry and very cold. So there's this tendency to always be moving to the west if you're from the east.
Yeah, for greener pastures, that's where that comes from.
Literally, the grass is mm-hmm. greener on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this flow of people over thousands and thousands of years who are going from east to west.
Right.
And ultimately, all these horse people, they would end their journey in the Great Hungarian Plains, you know, the last very edge of the steppe, because these are horse people, and unless they kind of assimilate into some other civilization, you know, they're not able to really thrive in another environment.
Mm-hmm. Also, there's like some natural boundaries that'll prevent them from moving easily with just their horses.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly. So they can't really go anymore when it starts getting more wooded and there's more rivers and, you know,
mountains, and then Western, there's also like seas and shit, you know. So like, yeah, like Western, just a natural stopping point.
Yeah, like Western Europe, there's a lot more the geography is a lot more conducive to, you know, creating like these larger metropolises. You know, the reason why Paris was such a great city is because it's by a bunch of rivers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's able to connect different parts in a country and become this centralized hub. So they stop when the steppe runs out.
Right.
Now, in the Altea Mountains, which is a mountain chain located where Russia, China, Mongolia, and Kazakhstan all meet. This is where you start seeing these predatory type nomads, the Scythian type people who originated from this area.
Yeah.
These more aggressive ones are, you know, the ones who spread out across other areas and started conquering shit.
Yeah. And I think we should probably pull it back for a second, just talk about the Scythians, because, you know, like this whole bit is like, you know, started about how the Russians are trying to clone the Scythians, and the Scythians are a steppe people, but I think they're pretty fucking fascinating in general. So I think it might be worth just like looking at them specifically. So, you know, you kind of pointed out already that they're nomadic people that ranged on that Eurasian steppe. Just as a reminder, they're estimated to have been around the 9th century BC to the 4th century BC, but they really came up in the historical record, around the time of Herodotus in the 8th century BC. And Herodotus...
Bring it back, Herodotus.
Yeah, we're always going back to Herodotus.
It's our favorite historian to talk about on this podcast. And man, this guy really...
Him and Plutarch,
just,
you know?
Him and Plutarch. But man, Herodotus has just... I mean, he's called the father of history for a reason. The right. fact that we reference him in like half of our episodes about something.
Yeah. I mean, anytime we're going to dip into the ancient, you know, ancient history of something, we're probably talking about Herodotus. And you know, he's a troubling source, to be honest. He's, for the Scythians, he's probably one of the only sources, to be honest. And we'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, Herodotus has four separate possible origin stories for the Scythians in his writings. But really, three of them are trash, and one of them is probably right. So I'll tell you all three. I'll start with the trash ones, and then I'll tell you the one that probably makes the most sense. So the first one, the Scythian legend. It's a Scythian legend about themselves, where their first king, some guy named Targetaus, apparently he was the child of the, quote, sky god, and the daughter of and a daughter of the Dnieper, which is a river near Smolensk, Russia, which, fun fact, not too far away from Pogorov, where Russia is amassing troops, by the way. So apparently they started from a sky god and a river. That's where they come from, according to one of Herodotus's legends, that he's repeating a Scythian legend about themselves, which is obviously, like, you know, it's akin with a lot of the other creation myths that we've talked about on the show, you know, from, you know, ancient Egypt, or, you know, even Sumeria or Japan or China, or literally anywhere where they're just talking about some kind of, like, you know, divine, you know, heritage. So clearly not a historical record. Another one, he got this from a Pontic Greek legend. So stories that the Greeks were telling about Scythia, and they told about a story of a different first king of Scythia, and his name was Scythes. And apparently he was the child of Hercules and a monster named Echidna, who was like a snake woman thing who lived in a cave. So I don't really know how, I don't know why Hercules put his dick in that, but apparently that's where Scythia comes from, and also probably why they're so nasty, because, you know, they're strong like Hercules, but they're also a monster like Echidna. It's weird story.
You know, it's funny because I was actually, I Wikipedia searched Hercules the show today, the 90s uh-huh. show. I don't know what made me think of it, but I don't know.
You were thinking about that?
Yeah.
Well, apparently
every once in a while I start thinking about Hercules and Xena Warrior Princess for some reason in the shows that came out of that time period.
Kevin Sorbo, that was the peak of his career.
That's how I got there, because I saw Kevin Sorbo on Twitter. That's how I fell in that rabbit hole.
And I almost, like, don't even want to know what he's talking about on Twitter. I feel like I'll be disappointed.
What?
With Kevin Sorbo,
you're not gonna like his takes. So I'll spoil it for you.
Yeah, so I'm just not gonna read that, because that'll ruin my childhood. Because I remember watching him.
Don't do what I do, man. I don't read any things. I try to stay away from celebrities and what they say, because I don't want like the. If I like a show or something, to
ruin it. Yeah,
I don't want their politics to make me
to ruin the show.
To ruin the show, so I just. I stay away.
I feel that. Anyway, here's another story from Herodotus about the Scythians. So this one, apparently, he got this from a Greek bard who traveled through the area, through the steppe. And apparently this bard said that the Scythians originally lived in the south of what's known today as the Ural Mountains in Russia. And then they got into beef with, like, another Central Asian tribe. That were probably cannibals, and also got into beef with some, like, one-eyed cyclops people who fought with griffins. That story is super fucking weird. I don't know what to make of that one. Like, you had me up until, you know, the one-eyed cyclops people. but apparently there was some beef with them, and that's where they came from. I don't know. But the most believable story and the most probable one, and admittedly the one that Herodotus believes the most, was that they probably came from a southern part of Central Asia, and there was a war with another powerful steppe tribe who lived in the northeast of Persia, and basically forced them to migrate west because they weren't able to fight with them. And then, you know, that's they all conglomerated towards the west and became what would be known today as Scythian. But, like, the whole backstory for an origin for the Scythians is messy and it's convoluted, and especially because it's possible that the term Scythian is just kind of a broadish term describing just the steppe peoples in that region during that time. But there was enough cohesion in the culture of the Scythians that we found, probably enough to consider them a whole peoples. But like a lot of things, it's kind of complicated. And I think part of why it's so complicated is because they were nomadic, right? And they were moving around, and there were a bunch of sub-tribes, you know? And, you know, they sometimes banded together and sometimes they didn't. It's confusing.
Yeah, you know? I mean, that's what I always assumed what the Scythians were. They were kind of just like this mysterious nomadic group that was kind of like a catch-all phrase to the people who lived in that area. But I guess through archaeological finds later, we were able to confirm that, hey, these guys actually had a lot in common, like culture-wise. Like, you know,
yeah.
Tribes that we found in Siberia have often a lot of things in common in places that are maybe closer to the Caucasus.
Exactly, exactly. So there's a cohesion about them, you know, that makes it probably more likely that they were, you know, like a cohesive unit of people. But again, the troubling part, and I don't want to, you know, spoiler alert or anything like that, but like the Scythians people, they just kind of like fizzled out. Like they just kind of disappeared.
And you kind of wish that you had Scythians.
The Chaldeans.
We still have Chaldeans, you know, have Scythians still.
Yeah, well, maybe we might. We'll talk about that in a bit. Because we're raising them from the dead. No. What's interesting about it is that there wasn't like a war or like an epidemic or like a mass migration that we know about for the Scythians. People just stopped talking about them and they just kind of disappeared, which is really interesting. We'll get to that part later. But, you know, I think the individual locations for this group of people is unknown because they moved around a lot, right? But definitely, you know, they ranged from, you know, the Danube River, you know, out in the west in like the European part of the steppe, and Mongolia way, way out there, you know, in the Asian part of the steppe, but also down south to like the Iranian plateau, which is more than likely where they come from genetically. Like they're an Iranian or Persian peoples. The general consensus is that they ranged over an extremely broad territory, which obviously would present, you know, some interesting variations among the Scythian people itself, right? There would probably be like, these are the, you know, Mongolic Scythians, and these are the, you know, Danubian Scythians, and so. But they all spoke roughly the same language, apparently. So,
well, if you look at a map of like just the ancient empires in, you know, 500 BC or so, like 600 BC, the old time, you'll always see that, you know, everything that's not a civilization is kind of like mapped out as Scythian. Like, oh,
everything north of like, you know, like Sumerian, or the
everything
Akkadian
north of Greece,
Empire.
Yeah. Everything north of like the Black Sea, just like Scythian.
Yep, that's Scythian. All of this, yeah.
Well, I mean, it makes sense though, because that's where a lot of our, going back to Herodotus, a lot of our people who are familiar with them from again the Dan Carlin podcast. You know, Dan Carlin did a 3-part series on called King of Kings,
right.
And it's about the rise and fall of the Persian Empire, essentially. Mm-hmm. So he goes through the rise of Cyrus the Great, and then he goes, you know, to Xerxes, and then he goes to ultimately the fall with Alexander the Great conquering it. But he talks a lot about like how, you know, Cyrus the Great's initial clashes with the Scythians, and how Cyrus the Great's death was actually a result of him fighting a Scythian princess, like a Scythian, a female warlord.
Yep,
women poetically fought. He was trying to marry himself off to make some type of an alliance.
Yep,
and she rejected that, and they went to war, and she poetically killed him on the battlefield, and that is not obviously something that is probably, there's a lot more myth to it than reality to it. It was
but
kind
there
of
is
a good
reality.
Story, but as what Herodotus said.
Women apparently did fight, and there's been archaeological evidence of like Scythian female warriors, which is pretty cool, you know? So there's some elements there. And we do know that you know, politics of the time, I mean, shit, politics now, you know, organizes itself around like weddings of convenience, you know, to, you know, either to prevent war or to create it in some cases, you know. So, you know, elements of that could be true for sure.
No, I think that it was just a convenient story to teach something, because ancient historians, there's things that are corroborated from Herodotus that we could confirm are true. They're like, oh man, Herodotus got something right about, you know, how, you know, Scythians that were in current day Palestine or something like that, right, as an example. Right. But then they'll realize, but this was a story that was also being used to teach a lesson, send a message, teach mm-hmm. a story about irony or something like that. Usually yeah. it's something ironic or something about morals or something that a story that kind of humility, you know, so these types of qualities that they want to instill within their society. So
totally.
That's why there's so much to take with a grain of salt. And with the Greeks, when they looked at people like Cyrus the Great, that's when they always looked at him favorably. And, you know, the Persians became corrupted later on by, you know, the corruption starts with like Xerxes. Like that's when, I don't know why I went off of that tangent, but however, I think it's relevant to kind of explain who they were or how they were represented at that time by the historians.
That's a good point. That's a good point. And I think that is a pretty good segue to what I wanted to talk about as well. You know, because a lot of what we know about the Scythians is like secondhand accounts, right? Like from Herodotus, et cetera. Or from these stories, you know, from like, say, the Persians, you know, things like that. And oftentimes, you know, they dehumanize the Scythians, and like the trouble with the Scythians is they didn't write shit down. Like, so we can't read their firsthand accounts of things. So, you know, oftentimes we get this kind of very superficial description of, you know, the Scythians and who were the Scythians like. And oftentimes it was very negative, you know, because they were a warring people, or at least, you know, they had warriors, right? So and I think I kind of want to return back to the geography again and talk about the steppe a little bit more in relation to the Scythians, because I think it helps kind of understand who the Scythians were really, you know? So we talked about how that geography plays a big role in the types of cultures that spring up, you know, like I said, on episodes of China. And in this particular steppe region, like you said, Henry, this geography really lent itself well to nomadic culture, and particularly animal husbandry. And that part is pretty important. You know,
animal husbandry. You mean like marrying animals?
We went over this already.
I don't know. It just sounds like that.
Yeah.
It just sounds like that in English, like animal husbandry. It just sounds like, oh, now they're marrying, sheep? They're marrying animals.
Yeah. No, that's not it. It's raising animals, basically raising cattle, sheep, you know, horses, know. Things like just, that.
It's a funny word.
But it's important that that's what they do, or that's at least their primary economic model is animal husbandry, because, you know, like, put it into perspective, this is the idea. The idea was that as the seasons changed, right, you mentioned, you know, that you could go from, you know, from the Western part, the European part, to, you know, Mongolia from spring to before winter, right? So it would take you not a super long time. And so the idea was, as the seasons changed, people would move around the range looking for, quote, greener pastures, so to speak, you know? So remember that part of the areas that these people ranged across, you know, was Siberia, where it's fucking cold as shit, you know? And so they'd go someplace warmer during the winter, and they would come back in the summer months. And oftentimes they would come back because they would just be following the animals that they were hunting, you know, because the animals would move back and forth in that same kind of pattern. And so they'd take the horses that they would raise and the sheep and the cattle that they would raise. And as they would move back and forth across the steppe, they would interact with and trade with more settled people along the way, right? And so this influenced pretty greatly, you know, their culture, but definitely their art a lot. For nomadic people, and this is kind of the trouble of being nomadic, there's often, you know, these like goods or, you know, materials that you can't really get your hands on because you're on the move all the time. But on the flip side, there's always an opportunity for you to trade because you have things that other people don't usually have. As an example, furs, you know, leathers. These things were in high demand pretty much everywhere. And, you know, a steppe, a grassland, is the perfect place to raise animals, right? So they were able to mass produce furs and leathers and hairs and wools and things like that. And these are all things that settled people who don't have a giant grassland to raise all these cattle on, you know, didn't have. So it was pretty mutually beneficial.
And also an interesting dynamic, which still kind of goes on today, is that they were trading with, at least from the accounts I've saw with them, heard about them trading with the Greeks.
Yep.
They would trade like, you know, their raw goods, their raw materials.
Leathers, wools, you know, rope from, you know, horse hair, things like that.
But they would trade it with, they would trade it for finished goods. So,
yep.
Like, what the Greeks would give them in return are things like...
They'd build them, like, here's a shirt.
A shirt.
You know, or here's some armor, you know?
Or armor, or swords.
Right.
Or wine, which is a was
well, they loved wine. That's actually a... That was a bit of their... what I was reading is that they had a really, like, fetish for wine, and they would often... like almost bankrupt themselves by giving away all of their wares for more wine. Like that was a big, cause you know, they don't sit around and they don't do it. And once they got a taste for it, it was just like,
what's interesting though, is that I feel like there's almost kind of like a level, like a spectrum with these ancient cultures. Especially with like, I feel like there's like more areas that you have like a greater degree of like Scythian like culture, like the like our Macedonia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not really Greek, or nope. I guess you can
not
argue
exactly.
All day. You can argue all day about, you know, whether Macedonia or Macedonia, whatever you want to call it, was Greek or was it its own thing? Was Alexander the Great Greek or was he Macedonian? Did he hate Greek culture? Did he, you know, you can debate about that all day. But one thing that's not debatable is that they used cavalry up there in Macedonia.
They used horses.
They used horses, and they were exposed to that
horse
type of
people.
Horse mm-hmm. people type culture, and it was more spread out and less mountainous like it
yep.
was down in lower Greece. And they just had greater exposure. It was kind of like a blend of, like, you know, civilized, like, you know, smart
sedentary
tactics and
lifestyle,
heavy infantry and
right.
stuff like that mm-hmm. with, you know, the wildness of...
of the horse people.
Of the horse people combined. And, you know, I think it's what made them so effective.
For sure. And it actually worked both ways too, right? Because on the one hand, like you said, the Macedonians were definitely influenced by the horse people in that respect. You know, you can definitely see so in the military warfare style of Alexander the Great. But it also worked towards the Scythians too. One cool bit was that, you know, Scythians loved gold. You know, and gold things, and they used a lot of ornate, you know, gold jewelry and art, and a lot of like you know, they would make these like olive branch, like golden olive branch crowns that looked like a Roman, you know, headdress. But that was actually kind of common among the Scythians, and they would adorn their weapons with gold, and you can see a lot of actual like Greek styling in some of the Scythian artifacts that have been found in some of these digs. And, you know, there's a lot of debate on where they come from. Some of them definitely were probably created by Greeks for trade with the Scythians. You know, like, as you mentioned, like, they would often sell them finished products. But also, there were still some evidence ones of Scythian artifacts that were just straight up mimicking Greek style, right? So they were actually creating their own ornate, you know, idols and artifacts and jewelry by themselves, but that mimicked Greek style. So like it worked both ways, you know, and their clothing, things like that, you know, were often mimicking Greek styles. And I think the widespread discovery of these types of artifacts really shows you how interconnected the Scythians were with their neighbors. One fun fact that I found out was that some artifacts that showed Scythian styling, or at least can be connected with Scythia, have been found as far as Korea and Japan. Did you know
well,
that?
That makes sense. I mean, that sounds very believable because
yeah.
the range of travel that these people lived within stretches from the west towards, you know, Manchuria.
Yep.
Manchuria is right over there by China.
Yep.
Aren't by Korea.
It's just wild how far out that gets and
Japan
like how
trade.
How the Scythians, you know, they made a small little impact on those, like, you know, far eastern, you know, cultures. And I think more importantly, though, that these artifacts depict the type of culture that the Scythians had. You definitely see a lot of war symbolism. Something you'll find a lot is a horse, like a guy riding a horse with a spear or a bow and arrow or something like that. So that was a big part of the Scythian identity, you know, is to be a horse warlord. Both inside Greater Scythia and their neighbors thought of them as like horse warlords. And that's obviously a, you know, product of the geography, right? That's how they grew up. That's how they learned how to defend themselves. That's how they, you know, economically how they provided for themselves. But there's also this interesting, like, big theme of three major symbols that show up. And one of them is a bird of prey. Another one is a horse or some other mammal, especially with, like, hooves or antlers. And the last one would be a wildcat, like a big, like a leopard or something like that. And they're often depicted together as being in conflict with one another. And some put forth the theory that this type of you know, symbolism in these artifacts was symbolic of the three realms, so heaven, earth, and the underworld, and they're constantly in struggle with one another. So, you know, these artifacts really show you that they weren't just this, you know, barbaric, like, kind of, you know, cannibal, like, crazy warrior people. Like, they were thinking about, like, the greater, the big questions in life. You know, they were philosophizing, you know, they had a religious and a spiritual cultural connection with this stuff. So it's, you know, looking at their artifacts really kind of humanizes them, at least against the types of ways that their neighbors would often depict them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, even the Dothraki, they had their little redeeming spiritual qualities.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Or did they?
That's true.
A Dothraki wedding with only three deaths is a boring affair.
So I was just going to say, like, you know, all of this is, of course, just a theory because the Scythians didn't write shit down. But lots of other people wrote things about them, and they left us clues in their artifacts. And so here's some interesting stuff that I learned.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot of people seem to believe that they are, you know, very violent horse warriors who were really dope at bow and arrows, and maybe they were using poison arrows. I kind of tend to believe that, just because of the nature of like their animal husbandry, and you know, their warfare was, you know, horse warfare. So that makes sense to me. There have been some accounts that shows them to have been mercenaries for the Greeks, and oftentimes were acting as elite bodyguards for, you know, high VIP people.
Well, that makes sense, because if they're not higher, if they don't have their own like cavalry regiments down in the city states of Greece, then if they want to hire,
might as well
some,
import them.
Might as well import them. And I'm sure these guys are looking for work.
Yep.
I'm sure you can make a pretty good living down back in those times.
If you
serving
were
a winning
lord.
City state, yep. getting the be on horse and sack a Greek city state.
Look Sounds at all like fun.
Wealth.
Yep. But that's probably where a lot of the negative connotations from them come from too, because you know they were like any mercenary is looked down upon. Any sellsword is going to be looked down upon, right? Because your whole job, you know, is to go somewhere else and do the dirty work for someone else. So, you know, the results of that often end up being that, you know, you're going to be, your whole peoples as a whole are going to get, you know, people aren't going to have very nice things to say about your people, you know?
Well, no one sold their swords more than Greeks.
Yeah, totally. But like, if we're talking about Greeks here, you know, like the Greeks would be pointing the finger right back at the horse people.
I mean, Greeks were mercenaries in the Persian armies that invaded Greece.
Yep, that's true. That's true. So there's some other accounts that were pretty interesting about how they might have used like hallucinogenic drugs for religious or ritual purposes. Not a ton of like archaeological evidence for this, because like obviously drugs like that like wouldn't have lasted that long, you know, for us to have seen it. But, you know, that's interesting. There was other claims, and this one is probably bullshit, but there were some claims that they were apparently cannibals and that they used the skulls of their victims as drinking cups, which is pretty metal, but I don't know if that's actually like fact. I don't know if that's fact or not. There's not a ton of evidence out there for that. But a few things that we do specifically know for sure are stuff that we get from their burial mounds that they left behind. So they obviously love horses. We know this for sure. They're total equestrians. And like they loved them enough where they would bury them with their masters. So the rumors of them being like horse masters are definitely true. We can just assume that from, you know, the way that they revered their horses. They loved getting inked. That's a thing. That's real. A lot of the mummies that they've been finding from these people have been just straight up covered in tattoos, which I think is pretty cool. But definitely would have been looked at, I think, especially probably from the Greeks, as like a bit of a taboo or whatever, you know, like these weird horse people with their drawings all over the skin and shit like that, you know?
It's interesting. I love the way, going back to Dan Carlin, but you know, I'm kind of forced to, because he just does he definitely introduced me to these, historical topics, because we don't learn shit about this type of stuff in most school in general. So the way that he explains the, kind of like the evolution of like the Mongolian horde and like the skilled horseback is, I'm paraphrasing it, but his way, he's like, just imagine generations of horse people training and shooting arrows, like, in that, you know, the Scythians were kind of like the precursors to the Mongolians, who were the, the most evolved version of the horse warrior they're basically, the horse and the person are connected. Like, you're basically one person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They're
like,
an extension
there's
of themselves,
no,
right?
They're, the horse is an extension of the rider.
Mm-hmm.
And he says something along the lines of, like, a horseback rider back then would be just way more skillful on a horse than the best like horseback rider now.
I believe that. That's all he did. Like, that's all they, like, that's all he had time like, for.
Yeah, because just if that's ingrained into your culture, like living on a horse and being on a horse at all time, like imagine like the best trick horseback rider who's able to shoot an arrow with his feet, and then imagine like a society of that.
Right. I mean, there's some truth to the, you know, the idea that they were the precursors to people like Mongolians and things like that, because, like I said earlier, you know, the Scythians just kind of ended up like phasing out. Like, there was no great war, there was no genocide, there was no epidemics, there's nothing like that. People just stopped talking about them, and it's very likely that smaller tribes within you know, the greater Scythia probably, you know, gained prominence, and you know, those peoples were assimilated. Like, specifically the Sarmatians, which I want to talk about a little bit, they ended up, they're one of the sub sub-Scythian tribes, and they ended up gaining power. And it's possible that just the rest of the Scythians just assimilated to that group, or maybe they all moved. You know, nobody really knows. You know, even the more interesting bits of this is that there have been some interesting, like, nationalist pseudo-origin stories. I don't know if you heard this one. You know, well, you know, there's this whole, like, 30-minute documentary that I was watching before this, about a theory that's like, it felt like a little bit like Ancient Aliens, to be honest, but it was by like these Russians from like these Russian universities and things like that. And they're basically making the case that Russians, or at least part of the Russian, you know, heritage, is actually just Scythians by another name, right?
Yeah, I've actually heard that as well. Right. So I have read stuff about that. So there's like a lot. This is really esoteric stuff. I just want to just start by saying that,
yeah,
like,
there are like a
few people who are like understand who like know about this stuff and read this stuff, including myself. Like, I'm not speaking on behalf as an expert. I'm just saying this is a very esoteric type topic, like the topic of like Eurasianist and things like that.
Yep,
you know, like kind of the schools of thought in Russia today.
Right,
they take root back from like the early 20th century. But this kind of relates to like the Eurasianist, where it's like you see there's like a interest in all the countries in like Central Asia and the Eastern Sphere banding together. What I've gathered is that in the 1910s, 1920s, this idea emerged that the Scythians were the descendants, or no, the Eastern Slavs were the descendants of the Scythians.
Right.
And kind of what this philosophy, it's called Scythianism. What this idea kind of centered around was Russia's location of being a borderland between the East and West, which gave it a sense of harmony, you know, like they gave this, like this quality of universalism within Russia.
Right.
And Russian society had a duty to be both, to balance both like European and Asiatic cultures. That's kind of like probably not a great explanation of what this was.
Well,
but it's the best.
No, it's pretty good. And I don't know if you heard about this one, but I found out through, you know, reading about the Scythians, because like I said, the Sarmatians eventually kind of superseded the Scythians, right? They're the ones that came after, and they ruled in the steppe area, but they were mostly on the west side of the steppe, in the European areas. And there is also a Polish-Lithuanian, you know, almost pseudo-origin story that posits that the Poles and the Lithuanians are actually the direct descendants of the Sarmatians. And that is called Sarmatism. And I want to bring this to you and say that maybe you are a horse person in the same way that I am a sea people. We figured it out, Henry. That's where we come
from.
You're
a sea person and I'm a horse person?
Yep, I'm a sea people and you're a horse person.
I identify more as a sea person, though. I love the beach and swimming and stuff.
Yeah.
So I identify as a C person. I'd like to think of myself as if I could trace my origins back, and if I discovered I was a C person, I'd be like, oh, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. Well, being a horse person is pretty cool as well.
Yeah.
I've rode a horse once in my life, like at a bullshit ranch when I was like 12.
Yeah.
Only time I've ever been on a horse ever in my life, so it doesn't come natural. And I remember having issues getting on it. Like, I was like, oh, fuck, I can't get on top of it. Embarrassed. And, like, the rancher was kind of hot, and I was embarrassed in front of her. I was like, oh, yeah. Man, it's embarrassing.
Just a poor excuse embarrassing for
this hot chick who's teaching me how to ride a horse.
Dude, this Sarmatism, like, this, like, ethno-cultural concept is actually pretty fucking fascinating, too. Like, maybe we'll have to talk about it in a different episode or something like that. But it's basically, like, this whole idea that was trying to, like, galvanize the Polish and the Lithuanian, you know, peoples as, like, having come from this Indo or Iranic descent, you know, which is fascinating. And, you know, it shows up in, like, their armor. It shows up in, you know, in the Polish armor, in the Polish, like, garb of the day, you know. Like, there were so many, like, inroads on that. And it kind of reads a little bit like, it's a little culturally co-opting, but at the same time it kind of makes sense because, you know, they idolized the Sarmatians as like these like horse warriors, and like Polish cavalry is like a thing, you know, like the Polish cavalry was and the Russian cavalry is a big thing.
Haven't you ever heard how you stop the Polish cavalry?
Oh god, here we go. How?
You just stop the carousel.
Oh man, apologies.
It's an old school Polish joke. How do you stop the Polish cavalry? Turn off the carousel. Yeah, well,
but yeah, I mean, well, they, well, like the Polish military at the time, you know, they definitely modeled it around like a strong like horse cavalry, you know. So it's interesting, you know, very very interesting.
So here's another thing to think about when thinking about how a lot of this is interpreted in the 20th century, especially during the time of like the rise of nationalism and the periods of like the Soviet Union marching westward during World War II.
Right.
Is that a lot of people like in the Czech Republic is a really good example, and Poland is a good example. A lot of these countries on the periphery of Eastern Europe, who are kind of Central Europe, a lot of the countries that now, you know, kind of wanted to get in NATO right away because they did not want to get into some type of Warsaw Pact ever again. A lot of them during World War II, there was a lot of propaganda coming out of like the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia, not the Czech Republic at the time, that kind of looked at the Soviet Red Army as kind of like this horde.
Yep.
This horde that was going to really Scythian just conquer horde. Everything on their way there. And honestly, like, I would have hoped to God I was liberated by the United States rather than the Soviet Union. Like, if I'm in that predicament,
hindsight
like,
being
shit,
2020,
man, you are shit out of luck. Like, fuck. Like, yeah, the Nazis are gone, but like, man, I really wish it was the United States that.
But
got
now
here.
I'm not going to starve.
But yeah. Now I'm going to have a secret police monitor me and all this stuff. But there was this sense of demonizing the Soviet, the Red Army, as kind of like this vague Asiatic menace threat. So and they would constantly group in like different kind of like exotic cultures to kind of play up the threat. So they'd be like, oh, the Mongolians and Georgians, and you know, even though a Mongolian and a Georgian are probably couldn't be further apart ethnically and, you know, language, linguistically.
Culturally.
But they would group them in together just to kind of add to that kind of horde mentality. Right. Almost it's, like how Herodotus would explain what the great Persian armies would look like on their way to Greece. You know, they'd be like, oh, they'd have like, you know, tribesmen from Africa with, you know, the horse people, you know, they'd name like every single culture that existed and there'd be warriors from it. They kind of had that same rhetoric, or they kind of propagandized the Red Army to say it the same way, where it was just like this grand Eastern army, and they tried to play up the Asiatic part of it, to make it more,
to make them different,
to make them more different and oriental and scary, to the West.
You know what this really reminds me of? Genghis Khan, Moscow. That song. Moscow.
Moscow.
Ruslan is Anchunislan. dude, because like if you look at the like the main like dancer guy, singer, whoever he is, right? He has kind of like that like more Mongol look to him. But if you look at the periphery, the like Genghis Khan as the group, you know, when you're watching this, these, you know, music videos and all the music that they make, they kind of represent that meme, you know, because each of them have a different look to them, you know, like one of them looks like this, like blonde, like, you know, like very Slavic looking woman. And then like the main dancer guy looks very like he could be the horseback rider guy, you know what I mean? And they have all this, like, they kind of try and in a meme way represent all of the different, you know, looks and phases of Russian culture.
That is interesting. Something else I've actually read about Scythian, there's something to be played about Scythians, or there's like a theory that the Scythians culture defeated the Mongolian horde. Like it was like Scythian culture that I've heard that before. I don't know. Have you ever heard anything like that?
Well, I know that they were that they did fight against not the Khans. It was who's the horse lords that they?
It wouldn't have been the actual Scythians because they had ceased to exist by the time that Mongols.
No, invaded, and I'm talking about the actual the Scythians,
the Huns. No, not the Huns.
Yes.
Oh, it was the Huns?
The Hun, but there's a specific Hun.
The Attila the Hun?
Attila the Hun, thank you.
But yeah, the Huns are another example of that, what that step, those steppe people that just kind of moved. Europe has been invaded so many times. There's been so many different invasions of Europe, which makes it just this really, really kind of hodgepodge of different like identities and cultures and things like that, because of just the pure. And not, I'm not even talking about like the more recent invasions in our history, like ancient invasions, like in the very, very prehistory world, there's been so many different migrations into Europe, which makes it, you know, I think like very unique. Now here's something else going back to,
it was the Sarmatians, but as you know, the Sarmatians were the, you know, the folks that came from the Scythians, or at least the ones that superseded them after a while, but same idea. Scythians Sarmatians fought the Attila the Hun and beat him back.
There's another thing in Czech culture, just to go back to that. There's also kind of like this sense of pride that the Czechoslovakians were the ones that beat out the Mongols. You know, everyone wants to take credit for something. Like, oh, it was us who beat them. It was our ancestors who defeated, who expunged the Mongols out of Europe. It's all interesting stuff. What else do you have to add?
Well, I mean, just kind of going back to the original like article that we were talking about earlier, you know, all of this information that we've been talking about have been basically coming out of the archaeological evidence that we're getting out of these Scythian burial tombs. And, you know, these are all in the, you know, Russian and Ukrainian areas, and the burial sites are called kurgans, or castles in Russian. And you know, what I think what's important about this is that there is this, well, first of all, the Siberian permafrost is able to, you know, keep well preserved all of these mummies and things like that, which is, you know, thankfully is why we're able to learn so much
new stuff about it. But, you know, it brings us to the original topic, you know, that Russia could be cloning the Scythians for some weird ass reason. Very likely, you know, this is just a bullshit, you know, clickbait article. But, you know, what I think is I find fascinating about the whole situation is that the Scythian peoples, right, inhabited the same land as what we would now understand the Russians and the Slavic people generally to inhabit. And they kind of just disappear, and they also pop up in this, like, you know, ethnic mythos of the Slavic people in that area. So, you know, I find it fascinating that you know, in this moment where we are legitimately, you know, having, you know, some tensions, you know, with Russia, especially on the Ukrainian border, that we're now getting an opportunity to revisit, you know, their history and like think about and learn about, you know, the potential places where they came from. You know, because I think it's, you know, it's very interesting that, you know, the whole region is a bit of a tinderpot right now.
Yeah. And
they have a shared origin, you know.
And what the goal is on one of our next episodes, we want to go back and forth, you know, tackle modern stuff as well as hit the historical stuff as well. But I think the next logical step to explain some of the differences and just like an overall kind of historical context that I think most people should know about this area of the world is probably going into the Kievan Rus, yep, which is the first state that emerges in that area, the first like place that we would consider a state, which emerges around 800-900 AD, so 1,000 years after the Scythians have ceased to exist,
long gone.
You know, right? There's an argument of who they are and what their combination are, but essentially it's like the Vikings, it's Norse people from Sweden and people from
Finnish
people, and all these different people, you know, collectively create a
but maybe some Scythians, Kievan,
and maybe some Scythians. But I think that is a topic that we need to hit on another episode, because that will open up a whole new can of worms. I just warn everyone to watch out for clone armies, and maybe we should start cloning our own armies to combat that. Maybe we should start cloning like
Comanche or something.
Comanches.
Like that,
you know? Ooh, yeah, that would be interesting.
Badass. Yeah.
That would be a good episode of Deadliest Warriors, the show that we were talking about the other day.
Yeah, totally. Clone the Comanches and have them fight the Scythians. Who'd win?
Yeah, let's. Well, who was the deadliest Native American tribe in North America? Was it? I mean, I think any of our tribes would probably lose though, because they didn't have iron weapons at that time.
That's true. Well, I mean, we'd have to even the playing field, right? Wouldn't we? Like, because you wouldn't put an American soldier today against, you know, a horse warrior, because the American soldier would win because they have guns, right? So like, if you were going to fight two people from different time periods that have different like technologies, wouldn't you just have to either give the Native Americans some, you know, iron weapons, or perhaps maybe increase their numbers? I don't know, who knows, to make it a fair fight.
Yeah, it would be an interesting TV show concept. All right, that's everything I had to say.
Yep, same.
All right. Thanks again for joining us for another episode of Bro History. If you enjoyed the content, you can get more content going to our Patreon, Patreon/ Bro History. You can join for just $1 a month. Extra content. Join our Slack community where we all communicate. And then another thing that's really helpful to help us is to rate and review the podcast if you are listening on Apple. The number one way to grow, the majority of our listeners, about 95% of our listeners come through Apple. One of the reasons why we get so many listens on Apple is because you guys rate and review the podcast, and it really does help us grow. It helps tremendously. So if you're listening on Apple, go to the star thing in the top right-hand corner. Go to rate and rate the podcast. Give it a 5-star review. Write us a nice little review. Say, hey, you guys are a great podcast, and I appreciate you guys, and I'd like to tune in every week. You can write that, or hey, you can even write, hey, you guys can go rot in hell.
Maybe the former.
I may disagree with you, but I'll fight to the death for your right to say it.
Yeah. but definitely do say it. And, you know, we're coming really close to that 500 mark, which is awesome considering where we started. So we really appreciate the
Yeah, get us the 500 reviews if you're listening to us. We're right there. All right. Enjoy your Sunday. This is when we're recording on Saturday. This should be released on Sunday morning. Have a wonderful week, and we will see you next week.
Peace.
Peace.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.